Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, a not-for-profit cooperative committed to helping employers self-fund by providing data and insights to manage their health plans. Info is at the-alliance.org.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Public Radio's own Mike Birbiglia tells us why he thanks God for jokes.
First, we're talking about the near-record-high levels of ice cover on the Great Lakes. For the first time in 20 years, the percentage of the Great Lakes basin covered by ice was above 90%.
Experts say if temperatures stay as low as they have been, the lake ice could break the 1979 record of 95% ice cover. This winter, we've seen another rare occurrence, a double maximum. I guess I'm told that's when the ice reaches a high, it falls to a lower level, and then goes back up to that high again.
George Leskovich is with us to talk about the ice cover and what it means for our environment. He's a physical scientist and manager of the NOAA Coastwatch Great Lakes program at the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. George, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
So this has been an extreme year when it comes to ice cover on the Great Lakes. What are current conditions?
Yeah, so as of yesterday, the Great Lakes had about 91% ice cover as a whole. And so that's, getting up there towards the record of 94.7, almost 95% set in 1979.
So you have to go back to 1979 to get more cover.
Yeah, we're not quite there yet, but it's approaching that.
Now, we may expect a pretty decent amount of ice cover on Lake Superior. Is Lake Michigan usually so ice covered?
Lake Michigan is about 92.5% ice covered now, 92.5%, and it was actually, the record was 93.1% set in 1977, and that's per our 40 years of record.
Is there still a chance that the winter of 2014 could bust those records from the 70s?
It's possible, depending on, the temperatures, how long the real cold temperatures persist, and also somewhat on the wind speeds and directions, because wind speed and can affect ice cover as well by breaking it up and moving it around.
Now, experts like yourself this year are talking about something called a double maximum. Can you tell us what that is and how rare it is?
Yeah, so usually ice cover forms in the fall or early winter, reaches a maximum, and then it starts to decline. And this is a normal progression. And but this year, on the Great Lakes as a whole, we're seeing two maximums. So the first one was about 88% which was reached on February 12th and 13th. And then ice cover declined on the lakes to about 61%, and then started to increase again. So I'd say as of yesterday, we're at about 91%. So there's two maximums this year, and that hasn't happened since 1996.
Now, I think from a civilian perspective, we can be inclined to look at this ice cover on the Great Lakes and go, holy smoke, this winter is crazy, and look at how much ice there is on the lakes. But as for the lakes themselves, how do they respond to seeing this much ice cover?
Yeah, so certainly this winter has been quite severe compared, especially to the past few winters. So there can be a number of effects, certainly on economy, on the ecosystem, and societal effects, certainly ecological effects could include could include effects on fisheries, for instance. Whitefish, one species, and there are some others that require a stable ice cover over their spawning beds during the winter. And if the ice cover isn't there, then the spawning beds are susceptible to winter storms. So with a stable ice cover, the fish recruitment it could help fish recruitment the upcoming season.
And in terms of water levels, that's something that's been of great concern recently, in particular people being concerned about water levels sinking. Is this something that, you know, the ice melts, the levels go up, and it's a good scenario?
Well, yeah, it depends. Of course, water levels depend on a number of factors, and the snow cover in the basin, how much snow enters the basin and melts, runs off into the lakes, how much snow leaves the basin because of lake effect snows. Some areas, especially around Chicago or Buffalo or upper New York, east of Lake Ontario, the shoreline is very close to the basin boundary, so winds can take lake effect snows outside the basin boundary, so when it melts, it goes down another drainage basin. So it depends on the snowfall. We've had a lot of snowfall this year, which is good for the water levels. And certainly the evaporation will affect lake effect snows. We've seen a lot of lake effect snow early in the season when there wasn't much ice cover on the lakes, but ice cover will tend to reduce evaporation and therefore the possibility of lake effect snows. And water levels can be affected if the ice cover is prolonged and lasts into the spring time, and keeping the water temperatures low. And if the summer is normal to cool, especially with a lot of cloud cover, those cool temperatures can persist into the summer and fall when most of the evaporation takes place. Therefore, with the cooler water temperatures, there'd be less evaporation that would affect water levels the next year.
Okay. So are you saying also that it could be a little cooler this summer up by Lake Superior or along Lake Michigan?
Along the shorelines of the lakes, if the ice persists into the spring, cooler temperatures, which could be good for, again, the fruit-growing industry, where the blossoms might not come out until later in the spring and therefore avoid the possibility of killing frosts because it's, you know, much later into the spring. So there could be a benefit to that industry as well.
Well, let's talk about an industry that might not be so happy about all this ice cover: shipping. Tell us how that's affecting the shipping industry.
Yeah, shipping is having a very difficult time this year. Of course, there's still shipping in the lower lakes. The locks at Sault Ste. Marie are closed, of course, so ships can't get up into Lake Superior. Locks open normally on March 25th, but in the lower lakes, there's still shipping, bulk carriers and tankers, and they're having a very hard time in the river systems, especially Lake St. Clair River, Lake St. Clair, the Detroit River, and especially western Lake Erie. And there were a number of ships beset in the ice earlier in the season that needed Coast Guard icebreaker assistance. And now I think the ships are waiting until they have a Coast Guard icebreaker escort before they move. And so, yeah, it's a very, very hard year on shipping.
Well, George, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
We've been speaking with George Leskovich, physical scientist and manager of the NOAA Coastwatch Great Lakes Program at the Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. He was joining us to talk about the near-record-high levels of ice on the Great Lakes.
Life has its ups and downs, the stuff you'd pay money not to remember, and the moments you want to keep forever in that highlight reel at the end of your life. For Mike Birbiglia, it all goes into magic machines and comes out transformed into stories and jokes like this.
I jumped through a second-story window, and I landed on the front lawn of the hotel. I took a spill. I got back up, and I kept running.
Mike Birbiglia has made a splash in public radio on PRI's This American Life as an author and director of the critically acclaimed movie Sleepwalk With Me. He's touring now with a new show called Thank God for Jokes, and he'll be in Wisconsin this weekend. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, Mike, your new show is called Thank God for Jokes. Why? Yeah. What do you love about jokes?
Why? It started off, I had my last two shows were these one-person single narrative shows. One was Sleepwalk With Me, which that was a piece of that you just played. And then the recent one is called My Girlfriend Boyfriend. And they were these off-Broadway shows that had a single narrative arc to them. And then I thought, you know, I'm just going to go back to just what makes me laugh the hardest. You know, I'm just going to tell a bunch of stories and work them out on stage over the funniest stories I can tell. And then what happened was that the more I worked it out over the last 2 years or so on stage, I found that actually the through line was actually jokes and humor and how jokes really get us in trouble, but ultimately make us feel closer to people. And so are sort of worth it in a way. And so that's sort of thematically what the show is about.
And for a lot of your career, your jokes have come in story form from your real life experiences, a lot of painful, embarrassing moments. Most of us might just try to push those moments down as far into our subconscious as we can.
Sure.
Why, for you, do they come out the other end as a joke?
And I do that too, by the way.
Oh, there's some stuff we haven't heard from you.
Yeah. I'm not immune to that. You know, a lot of these stories that, you know, like the titular story from My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, for example, was a story that I really was uncomfortable telling, like, even friends for years and years and years. Like, it's a story about how when I was in high school, I had my first girlfriend, and I was so excited. But then she told me that she had another boyfriend and that they're in the process of breaking up, but it was a bad time. His parents were sick and all this stuff, and I went along with this until finally she invited me to meet her parents, and I was like, okay, this is the vindication I need. And I drive to her house and I meet her parents, and then this other guy comes over, and it's dawning on me that I'm hanging out with my girlfriend's boyfriend, and it's going pretty well, you know, like he seems like a nice guy, and he suggests we go hang out at his house. This is entirely true, by the way, and I meet his parents. And I say, it's completely surreal meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time, because part of you is angry, and then part of you still wants to make a good impression. You're like, well, maybe if this goes well, you just want to succeed. But so anyway, that's actually one of these stories where, like, that happened when I was probably about 16 or 17 years old. I literally wasn't comfortable repeating it to my best friends until I was like 27 years old.
Wow.
And I feel like now, I at this point in my career, like, I've made this discovery of just, no, that's what you should dig into. Like, you should dig into the most painful stuff. And at first, it's not the funniest stuff, but long-term, in my opinion, I think it is.
I don't want to go all public radio on you here, but do you think that makes it easier to bear because you take the painful stuff and you're laughing about it and all of a sudden it's therapy?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's crucial. I work with a director, a theater director, when I develop these shows, and for us, it's crucial that it's not therapy. Like, it's crucial that ultimately it's about the audience, and that the audience is laughing really hard because they're identifying with something in their life. Like, when I first told them My Girlfriend's Boyfriend story, the one I was just telling you, like, on stage, like, in a way, it was like therapy because it, you know, I didn't know whether the audience would laugh, but then the more they laugh and the more that I hone the certain lines and beats and the arcs of these stories, the less it becomes like therapy. Because the craziest thing about the tour of that show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend tour, I toured it to 70 cities around the world, Australia, Canada, and UK and everything. A zillion people came up to me. I'm not, probably like 40 or 50 people came up to me after shows and would say, that exact same thing happened to me. And I'm like, Laura, what?
Wow.
That? That thing? I mean, I thought that was so specific to me, but But I find that the more you share with people, the more you find out just how crazy sort of everyone's lives really are.
We talked about the process of honing and refining, and ultimately you turned one of your most famous stories into that movie we mentioned, Sleepwalk With Me. Let's listen to another clip here.
About 7 years ago, I started walking in my sleep, and I would have these recurring dreams that there was a hovering insect-like jackal in our bedroom. And I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and I would jump on the bed, and I would strike a karate pose. I'd never taken karate, but I had the books from Book Fair, and I would say, Abby, that was my girlfriend, there's a jackal in the room. And she got so used to it, she could talk me down while remaining asleep. She said, there's no jackal in the room. Go to bed. And I would say, are you sure? I jumped through a second-story window, and I landed on the front lawn of the hotel. I took a spill. I got back up, and I kept running.
So some clips there from, again, your Sleepwalk With Me story that's from The Moth. It was turned into a film as well. So some of the end of that story, there are glass shards stuck in your leg, you're in your underwear. It doesn't sound like it would be that funny. So how, what is the process for you of working through that material and making it as funny as it can be?
Yeah, it's definitely, these are stories that are definitely not funny in the early stages. They're stories that you... When I first put him on stage, in the movie Sleepwalk With Me, my character is a bartender at this bar in Brooklyn called Union Hall. And in real life, I actually lived down the street from Union Hall. I was actually there last night. I do a show called Working It Out, and every Monday night. And I put a ton of stuff on stage that is really, it's not carved out. You know, it's not done. And the audience knows that, you know, coming in, they know that that's what they're getting. They're getting the unadulterated version. And, that's sort of how I hone these things. A lot of it is I write out a version of it, and then I go on stage and I try to memorize it. And then I go on stage and I go wherever, you know, the audience takes me. You know, I go into details if they're getting laughs, or I go in, you know, I kind of modify on the fly. Stand-up comedy is a really unique art form in the sense that, in a lot of ways, the audience tells you what is funny about you. You know what I mean? Like, there's actually a famous Jerry Seinfeld interview from the early '80s before his sitcom, where he says that to be a stand-up comedian, you have to listen to the audience. You know, the audience will tell you what's funny about you, and then you sort of have to build from there.
I've read some work lately by comedians saying that, if I can paraphrase Rodney Dangerfield, we don't get no respect. People think you just get up and you kind of off the top of your head lay out some jokes. Are you underappreciated as a comedian and in that people don't see the work that goes into it?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's the nature of the art form. The nature of the art form is kind of it's conversational, and it's the illusion of there being no effort. And I feel like if you took away the illusion of there being no effort, then it would feel effortful for the audience, and you don't want it to, right? I mean, I feel like the stand-up comedy shows that I'm at that I don't like as much is when I feel stressed out as an audience member. And that's what I strive to do in my shows, is just to create a feeling in the audience where it's like, oh, this is just fun. Like, you don't have to feel pressure to laugh. You don't have to feel pressure to be serious or clap or whatever. Like, you know, I always hate it when MCs of shows will come out and go, you guys ready to laugh? You know, and people are like, oh, I guess so. And they're like, I can't hear you. And I'm like, you can hear them. Everybody can hear everybody. No, you don't have to scold people for being audience members. And, yeah, that's the other thing that frustrates me, too, is when, you know, a comedian will get on stage and, you know, there's not a lot of people in the audience, which, trust me, I've been in a lot of those situations, and a comedian will, like, scold the audience for being the only people there. You know what I mean? Like, where are your friends? Where are your family? Like, no. These are the people who showed up. You need to be nice to these people.
We're talking right now to Mike Birbiglia, writer and star of the show Sleepwalk With Me and My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. He's also a regular on Public Radio International's This American Life. He's got a new show that he's touring right now. He's going to be touring it in Milwaukee and Madison this weekend, and it's called Thank God for Jokes.
And coming up, we'll talk about the value of jokes, the overlooked value of jokes in our daily lives, and we'd love to take your questions for Mike Birbiglia at 800-642-1234. What do you get out of a joke? Does turning your life into a laugh help you get through it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're back now with Mike Birbiglia, writer and star of the hit shows Sleepwalk With Me and My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. He's also a regular on PRI's This American Life. He's touring a new show now called Thank God for Jokes.
Mike, in a lot of our daily life, there's not only always time for the messing around, for the jokes. What do we miss out on when we don't joke around?
That's a good question. You're turning me into my philosopher.
What
self,
do you so think I, of jokes, Mike?
This is very dangerous. All I can think about is that it's going to be, listening to your newscast, that it's going to be 5 to 10 degrees when I arrive there.
Sorry about that.
At least I'm not upstate in the negative 5 degrees.
That's right. It's a little things.
Yeah, I don't know. Jokes are ultimately about, in my opinion, they're about communication. Like, I think that I think back to the parts of my life where I experienced the most joy, it's like when I'm like sitting around with my family around the dinner table at Christmas, like late at night, and we tell stories from our year and tell stories from when I was a kid and that kind of things. And those are moments when I personally feel just most connected to the people around me. I feel like sharing inside jokes with my wife, I think, is like one of the most special things about being married, is having, it's almost like a language. It's like you're sharing something that is often my wife and I will have a joke that is funny to me and her and no one else other than maybe our cat. and I think that that's special. Like, I really do. I think I feel like, so much of our lives is taken with, the drill of getting to work and paying bills and all this, raising kids, all this stuff that people do. And you have to laugh or else it's just, you can go a little crazy.
So you say your cat finds you funny sometimes and nobody else, but you do make a living as a comedian. And I know you've got a little bit in your new show, Thank God for Jokes, about meeting a guy at a party. And he kind of goes, well, you're not being funny now. How can you be a comedian?
Come on, funny guy.
I will say that is the odd thing. I flew to St. Louis. I flew to St. Louis today. I have a wild week. I flew to St. Louis today, and then I drive to Chicago tomorrow because I'm taping Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is fun. It'll fair this weekend. And then to Madison, then Wisconsin, and then Milwaukee. But, I was talking to the guy on the plane today, and I don't really say, when some people ask what I do, I don't say I'm a comedian because it's just, there's too much baggage to it. You know, like, I was at a party a few weeks ago, this guy goes, oh, yeah, you're a comedian, then how come you're not funny now? And I wanted to just say, well, I'm just going to take this conversation we're having, repeat that to strangers, and then that's the joke. You're the joke later. And it's true. I mean, that's all it is.
Didn't your surgeon or something or some doctor or professional use the word comedian in air quotes when he was treating you?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that happened recently. I'll tread lightly on that. What it was, but I was going to see my urologist, and I had a symptom that was disconcerting, and I tried to make an appointment, and it was over Christmas, and so he wasn't in the office, and so I emailed him I emailed him my symptoms because I was so nervous of whether I should come in right away. And it was a very personal email. Like describing urological symptoms in an email is very tricky. And I even said in the email, by the way, this is the most personal email I've ever written. And he wrote back, shouldn't be a problem. Just come into the office in a few weeks. And then he CC'd a third party who I did not know. And I was like, come on, man. You can't CC a third party on this one. This is private. And then when I was in the office, I talked to them and I said, hey, maybe you shouldn't CC other people when I email you the details. Because I'm a comedian. And he goes, you're a comedian? And I was like, yeah. And then when we were checking out, I think that's not what it's called, but we were at the desk where they tell you they don't take your insurance. he said to the woman working there, he goes, this is Mike Birbiglia. He's a comedian. And he air quoted it. And I was like, no, not air quotes. This is my job. You must believe me. It's like I don't want to be famous, but I do want to be famous enough that my own doctor knows who I am.
And speaking of being famous, now you're public radio famous. I don't know if we want to throw air quotes around that or not.
Sure,
you've toured before that, and now you're touring after that. What's the difference?
It is different. I mean, I'll tell you, like when I do my shows, when I do my shows now, it's a little bit more like everybody is in on the joke in a certain way. Like there's a, similar to what I was saying about like me and my wife, it's like there's a shorthand with my audience because they know my sense of humor. I don't, like when I was starting out, I would do a lot of shows where it would be like, tonight, comedy, you know, and then I would go on stage as one of five comedians. And typically, the audiences would not enjoy me because I was different from the other comics, you know, like I was sort of more soft-spoken and that kind of thing. Typically about 3 out of 100 people would come up to me afterwards and be like, hey, by the way, almost like it was a secret, actually my favorite. They'd have to say actually, which is offensive. And they would say, you know, you're my favorite. And then I think over the years what's happened is that those 3 out of 100 in every audience has kind of gathered together. And they comprise my audiences now. And so now it's like a really, like when I show up, like I'm doing 2 shows in Madison, 2 shows in Milwaukee. And like, you know, people are excited from go. Like I don't need, it doesn't take 10 minutes to kind of get everybody on the same page.
So you got all the Mike Birbiglia fans together. That's nice.
It's not, yeah. To be honest with you, it's really nice because I don't have the baggage of having a hard time walking down the street because I'm not famous in that way. But when I tour America, people show up and they go to the shows on purpose, which is great.
So in public radio, storytelling is still a really hot watchword. And in lots of ways, that's what you do with your stories that you tell, whether about your urologist or your sleepwalking.
Sure.
And, you know, you've got guys like Marc Maron he's out of his garage and he's telling
sure.
stories about his personal life while he's interviewing people. I mean, do you think stories have sort of reached their tentacles everywhere, including the comedy world? And now it's okay to tell these kind of longer form stories as long as they're funny at the end.
I think so. I really do. I think I feel like what happened is and I'm saying this being a huge fan of Jerry Seinfeld and a lot of comics in that genre. I think that that observational comedy, short form observational jokes, were so popular in the 80s and 90s that. I feel like what we're experiencing now is a little bit of a backlash to that in comedy, which is people don't so meaningless. People want to actually, you know, people want to, you know, show you. I feel like you want to get to know you. I feel like in the best case scenario, performing, they're giving a piece of themselves to the audience. That's a gift. And I feel like, yeah, it is a little bit in vogue right now, but it'll probably swing back the other way in like 5 years. So who knows?
So enjoy it while it's here.
Yeah, exactly. But I think in a lot of ways it's a return to like what Richard, like I feel like a lot of us, Mark Maron included, Doug Stanhope, I think Louis C.K., I think probably Maria Bamford, like a lot of us are inspired.
Mike, we're losing our connection now, and we're about done anyway. We'll let you go. Mike Birbiglia, thank you so much for joining us today.
This is a real pleasure. Thank you.
And I hope you enjoy Wisconsin. That was comedian Mike Birbiglia, frequent contributor to PRI's This American Life and director of the film Sleepwalk With Me. His new show is Thank God for Jokes. He's playing Milwaukee and Madison this weekend. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn about Wisconsin Transit Week and the perks of public transportation.
But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This weekend, teams from around the state will compete in the WIAA State Team Wrestling Competition. High school wrestling is a Wisconsin institution, and Kaukauna High School is perennially one of the top-ranked programs. Seth Jovog spoke to the man in charge about his passion for the sport.
You know, if you watch animals in nature and you watch little kids, when they first are rolling around in the living room with mom or dad or their uncle or whatever, they want to wrestle. They want to scrap. They want to get in there and play. What's special about wrestling is it's very natural. It's very instinctual. My name is Jeff Machick, and I coach the Kaukauna High School wrestling team. I'm 46 years old. I got my first job here in 1991 and have been here for 23 years. I teach physical education. I've taught that K-12 for all the years here. There's a reason I live across from the school. My wife and I decided that'd be a good place to live. It's a kind of a double-edged sword. And you end up being here a lot more than you want to, but you know, this is kind of a home away from home for me. I was inspired by a lot of the pioneers of Wisconsin wrestling. Growing up, I wrestled at Pulaski High School. My wrestling coach is a Hall of Fame coach. He wrestled for Billy Martin, a Wisconsin Hall of Fame coach. That's the Hall of Fame is named after. And it's just like once you are touched by people that have embraced their chosen field, I guess that kind of bleeds. I know we've evolved as people and we want X game and we want a lot of bling and all that stuff, but with wrestling, I just think it's the purity of it. It's you against one in combat. It's my weight against your weight. We're not compared by anything but two people of equal size, and as you advance up the ladders in tournaments and competitions, equal ability, and it comes down to willpower. It comes down to dealing with adversity like you've never felt before. I've played a lot of sports. I've coached a lot of sports. But the winning, it's so great in wrestling when somebody in your family or somebody in your group or yourself wins a big match. And losing can be so lousy. Can take you to a dark place that you don't feel with any other sport. You know, people say you got to get up off the mat. Well, that came from wrestling. You have to get up off the mat. You've got to get back and train and find a way to forget about it. And it's very, very tough to do. I think it has a lot to do with Wisconsin, the hard work, the pride, the fighting spirit. And I think that's why wrestling is so popular. You know, in the Midwest, it really has a place in our culture.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
This week is Wisconsin Transit Week, an effort to celebrate the public transportation system here in Wisconsin.
That system includes urban and rural bus programs and shared ride taxi systems. Just over half the population of Wisconsin has access to our transit systems.
Craig Thompson is here. He's executive director of the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Craig, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, when I think public transportation, I think cities, first of all, but there's a lot of rural public transportation out there. What kind of things are out there?
Well, in the more rural areas of the state, there are shared ride taxis. There are, you know, some vans. There's also special transit for elderly and disabled as well.
What are the benefits for us here in Wisconsin of having public transportation available to us?
Well, there's a larger segment of the population than people think that don't have a car, don't have access to a car. And there's also a significant portion of choice riders. And for those folks, it's almost 70% between going to work or going to school, what people are riding the bus for or taking transit for. So, you know, I think it's a huge benefit to be able to connect people to either jobs or to school or to go train to get the skills to get a job.
Can you talk about the economic benefit a little more? What do we have a number on that? How much we get out of just connecting people from home to work or school?
I don't have a dollar figure on that, Rob.
Okay. So you also on your press release about this talk about seniors. We've got a growing population of aging baby boomers. How does public transportation help them in terms of mobility?
Well, as I think has been covered a lot and people are aware of, we do have a huge influx of the baby boomers reaching 65 and older. And as we do that, there's a lot of folks that maybe are not going to be able to drive anymore and some that maybe shouldn't. And so when there's a public transportation system available, I think it helps everyone out.
So how much is this changing? How much is this changing our transportation priorities here in the state, this need for more people to have alternatives to cars?
Well, I think that remains to be seen how much our priorities change. I'm not sure they've changed significantly yet, but I think as policymakers begin to look at this more, I think the idea of more funding for our transit systems in our urban areas as well as some form in our rural areas is going to have to become an imperative.
One of the first things people think of when it comes to public transportation is environmental impact. How, comparing public transit to all of us driving cars, what kind of difference does that make?
Oh, you know, it's significant. If you think about for each person that's on a bus, if you have 50 people on a bus, that could be a lot of times we've got solo riders on the road. That's 50 different cars just alone just for that bus that's not on the road. So when you start doing the math and thinking about the impact on the environment, it's significant.
We're talking about Transit Week here in Wisconsin, recognized by the state government, trying to draw attention to and a little bit celebrate public transportation here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a user of public transportation? Why or why not? Is there something that you would use if it were available to you? Call and tell us about that, too. Again, 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Craig, as you know, working with the state government and local governments, there's been an ongoing controversy or back and forth about how to fund public transportation in areas, metropolitan areas of the state, regional development authorities when it comes to organizing and paying for transportation. What is the current state of the art? Where does that stand around Wisconsin now?
Well, in Wisconsin, our funding for our transit systems really is basically from the state. It's the money that the cities and Milwaukee County get from the transportation fund, and then the property tax dollars that the local government puts in. Those are really the two sources that we use in the state, and it's really very unusual compared to most states. Most states that have any urban areas have some local funding mechanism other than the property tax, like a local sales tax or some sort of regional way to let communities decide what level they'd like to fund transit at.
What are some of the gaps or maybe opportunities, to phrase it more positively, that our public transportation system has in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's room for huge upside for our transit systems in Wisconsin. You know, the last week I went and took the Route 6 from the Capitol Square out to Madison College because we had talked to some of the folks at Madison College. The students there back in 2000 voted to add on a fee. Right now it stands about $46, a commuter services fee. And so it took the Route 6 out there, and it's incredible the amount of people going out to Madison College that are taking advantage of that. And we talked to so many people in all different disciplines, going to school for all different things out there. And, you know, they said the ones that did take it said many of them, they couldn't even go there if it wasn't for that bus pass that they get as a result of that fee. And the other thing is, we talked to some of the student senators there, and they said their number one issue out of Madison College that they hear from students there is about parking. Parking is at a premium there. So even if you're not riding the bus, every person that is, that's one more chance to have a parking spot for the people that are driving.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Barb with us in Eagle River. Barb, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Up here in northern Wisconsin, we don't have public transportation. And it is truly a handicap for not only the elderly, but people going to work, people going to school. It doesn't exist up here.
All right, yeah. So in a less densely populated area, Craig, what kind of options can there be, and how do people make those happen in their communities?
Well, I think sometimes, you know, it takes some of the local governments and others to be creative to figure out ways, because I think, as the caller is saying, it can be very isolating in areas of the state if there's not access to public transportation. The Department of Transportation has done a metric where they've studied this, and they look at, there's about 54% of, I think you'd mentioned, Rob, about 54% of the population of Wisconsin is considered to, quote, have access to transportation. The DOT Secretary Mark Gottlieb has set a goal that they want to get that up to 75%. And so hopefully that's something we're going to move toward.
We'll go now to Tiger in Green Bay. Tiger, hi. Oop, and we've lost Tiger in Green Bay. We'll go to Steve in Madison now. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess my question is, what does it take to get public transportation from Madison out to outlying districts? For instance, how do we get public transportation from Madison to, like, say, Marinette, Menominee, Madison to Eagle River, Madison to Duluth, Superior? What does it take to do that? There's very little bus transportation that takes people to those areas now.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. Craig, so that's kind of intercity, expanding the networks from places like Madison, Milwaukee to smaller communities around the state.
Right. I mean, there are some intercity bus services right now in Wisconsin, but as far as making that more robust, you know, I suppose that's an issue, again, that comes down to funding, and that would probably have to come from the state, because you're talking about a lot of different, you know, municipalities would have to be working together to do it a different way.
Time for another quick call from Barb in Viroqua. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I'm just calling to make a comment. I ride the Smart Bus, which is the Scenic Mississippi River Transit,
mm-hmm.
and that route goes from Viroqua to La Crosse, Wisconsin. And
right.
I take that to work every day.
Oh, okay. That's one I'm not familiar with. Thanks, Barb. Craig, in our closing moments here, is that a solution that more communities could look at?
Well, I think, you know, the line that she's talking about has been very successful. Mm-hmm. Some companies have actually partnered with, you know, Epic here in Madison has actually entered into a contract with Madison Metro. So I think there's creative ways to look at it. But, you know, the benefits really are many. The one thing I'd like to mention, Rob, if I could, too, is one of the things we wanted to do during this week to make it fun is we're asking people that are riding the bus or taking transit to tweet and send us pictures or just a message about how they use the bus to get to work or school or wherever they're going. And that's at hashtag WI Transit Week.
All right, Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, talking about Wisconsin Transit Week.
Coming up on Central Time, how slowing down could help learning. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.